sometimes I would just sit by the radio and hope that I could get in and join those people. They were having such fun and I wanted to be with them for the world they were living in, you know? The whole life going on in there.
How would you get in it if it was so small?
Yeah, but, you know, that's what I was wondering.
Welcome to How to Enjoy Experimental Film. With those words, Ruth Novacek opens her 2010 film Radio. It is the introduction to an intense but entertaining montage, a visual equivalent to speeding past several stations on a radio dial. This is in fact one of the images in the film, or even a kind of visual singer-songwriter album. The visual material was shot by Ruth herself, coupled with an array of found footage from near innumerable sources. Similarly, the soundtrack is a patchwork of speech and music of various styles and various genres. The rapidly alternating assemblage has become characteristic of Novacek's style, which she refers to as bricolage. Ruth Novacek studied fine art at St. Martin's, going on to gain a practice-based PhD from the University of Westminster. She comes from an international family. Her father was Czech and her mother was German. Ruth herself has lived in London, New York, and Tel Aviv, among other places, and a sense of restlessness pervades much of her work. Images of travel are to be found in nearly all of her films, often referencing mainstream movie clichés in their imagery. Her artistic interests are similarly wide-ranging. Ruth comes from a background in painting, but soon started making films. She has also played in bands, worked as a DJ, and curates exhibition, but her film work seems to have come as somewhat more of a surprise.
So, I was painting, and I was getting quite frustrated with painting because I was also doing music and writing, and it just seemed like, how did I pull them together? And then somebody asked me if I would film them setting fire to some laundry on a washing line. And they gave me this Super 8 camera and I looked through it and I thought, oh, that's it. That's what I could be doing. So I got a Super 8 camera from my dad that he didn't use. And I started making films. And I went to St. Martin's. And it was, you know, the early film and video courses in art schools. And Isaac Julian was there, Sandra Lahir, Martine Toquen. So I, you know, and Anna was one of my tutors. I really learned a lot from that. I just didn't quite know where I was going with my own work. And it didn't really fit somehow. Mm. Because I took the idea of the avant-garde to mean that you're free to make your own language in cinema. And I call it cinema, not film, because, you know, there's this sort of preciousness about 16mm or film and the materiality of everything, which just wasn't me. I mean, I didn't really like very much film. Maya Deren made sense. Shirley Clarke, maybe. That was that. So St. Martin's was really important.
And when you say you'd become frustrated with painting, had you almost always intended to go in a sort of painterly direction?
Yeah, it's like that's all I knew because, you know, film wasn't on the agenda in art classes at school. And before I went to St. Martin's, I'd been studying art history as a kind of, well, my parents weren't particularly interested in me being an artist. So art history at the Courtauld was a kind of, oh, I could just become an art historian or something. And then I realized that it wasn't what I wanted to do at all. Yeah. I wanted to actually be an artist. So the painting was, kind of, that's all I knew, really. It's like, if you wanted to be an artist, you had to be a painter.
Novacek's breakout film was Tea Leaf, made as a graduation film at St. Martin's in 1986. The film takes the form of a confession to the filmmaker's new lover, recounting a past traumatic experience. Originally shot on Super 8, the film was re-photographed off the screen using two projectors to create superimpositions within the montage from each machine. The continuing success of Tea Leaf, however, is something of a mixed blessing for the filmmaker, as it does come at the expense of appreciation of her more recent work. So we're going to move swiftly on to discuss some of these more recent pieces. When Ruth was studying, the London Filmmakers Co-op was the prevailing force for experimental cinema in the UK. But Ruth quickly found herself at odds with this scene.
I think the impression I got was that men had made the rules and it was supposed to be avant-garde, but how could it be avant-garde when it had rules? And I felt like, why can't women break the rules? I mean, I was in bands at the same time that, you know, there were lesbian feminist bands that were basically imitating male bands. And I was quite into, you know, bands like the Slits, who were redefining music on their own terms. And I thought that's what I wanted to do with film. And I think it was in the, well, Ackerman certainly, because she's Jewish and a lesbian, you know, obviously resonated for me. And I think that was really, that's another thing, you know, Jewish identity was not of any interest whatsoever in the sort of co-op setting. I mean, Peter Goodall, who was actually one of the only men that I really approved of at that time, because he had actually said, like, we've got to stop objectifying women. And he was the first one to say it. Yeah. He was Jewish. So even though not particularly identified, like at the time, nobody particularly wanted to talk about being Jewish.
I heard sort of conflicting reports from the time. You know, I've mentioned hearing somebody talk about the structural reign of terror at the co-op. But
yeah,
you know, I have spoken to others who did not feel that there was, you know, that there was a strident philosophy, but didn't feel that it was being aggressively imposed necessarily.
I don't think it was. I think, you know, on some level, everybody wants to belong. With art, anyway, you kind of fit yourself into a school, whether you admit it or not. And it's like, you know, the gang you want to be in. So, you know, some people, like Alia Syed's work, fits very well into that school. And yet, you know, she's brought with it a kind of Asian perspective. And, you know, there's very little. You know, the whole thing was pretty white and male.
But in some ways, it also became very desexualized, I guess.
Yeah.
Almost puritanical. So,
except for Steve Dwoskin. My work isn't asexual, but it's not primarily sexual.
With its pointedly international content as well as clear exploration of Jewish culture, lesbian romantic relationships, and a profound sense of restlessness, Ruth Novacek developed what was described earlier as bricolage. The films are a tapestry of interwoven sounds and images from various sources, fragments of narrative and narration providing a sense of cohesion. But as viewers, we are left with a series of impressions from which we are allowed to draw our own conclusions. And so was that the bricolage notion, was that there immediately for you? Or did that develop?
No, it wasn't. It was only, I mean, it's got a lot to do with the technology. So let me just think, like, when I went to New York, yeah, I was really impressed by, you know, the landscape, New York City. And also, when we moved to upstate New York briefly, there was this amazing kind of scary landscape, sort of dark streets, houses with porches at Thanksgiving and Christmas, snowy landscapes, this kind of mountains even in the Berkshires. So it was like completely different, because, you know, the English pastoral doesn't, I don't know really what to do with it. You know, I'm an urban London Jew, so, you know, but the American landscape seemed kind of familiar and cinematic and fantastic. So that down there. But then when I could rip DVDs or, you know, quote, it seemed like a really exciting thing. And it's also to do with the technology, because I could take somebody else's film and splice it in with your own. But I didn't really do that until much later. And okay. It was definitely to do with technology, DVDs, being able to rip, that kind of stuff. Before that, I was just really thinking about how to cut things together. Like Abigail Child talks about putting things together that don't go.
Well, actually, that was going to be my sort of follow-up, if not so much bricolage and quotation, but montage seems important.
Yeah, very. And I think that's the most exciting thing. Like, I'd gather together, like, footage, imagery that I really liked, and then sort of figure out how to put it together.
It was a long journey. It didn't make sense. Nothing really connected. And it was dangerous. Not in an overt way, more of a covert threat, which I later realized was just folly on my part. A delusion I'd wrought into a fragmented narrative of my own downfall.
Within the dense, textured worlds of Novacek's films, there is still plenty of humour. Plus, existing in a multimedia landscape as we do, the bricolage method seems entirely natural, as if we turn our heads walking down a busy street, taking in an advert here or a headline there, a movie reference here or an audio fragment there. If you're keen to experience this distilled into a short film, you can find many of Ruth's films on her website, Vimeo page, and two DVDs. One of these DVDs features one of her longest films at 23 minutes, The New World. Subtitled A 21st Century Bricolage, this was Ruth's PhD film, combining quoted material with footage recorded with a mobile phone and Super 8 film. A fractured narrative of loss and failure is married to images referencing and taken from popular culture, much of which is narrated by Ruth herself with a slightly affected vocal performance. The work prompted Chris Krause and Dina Johnston to describe Ruth as the Patti Smith of film.
Really, I'm a failure. Failed rock and roller, failed poet, failed eros, failed thanatos, a failure of desire and its sweet tangents, a stumbler into holes.
Five shorter films are collected on a DVD collection called Radio, featuring the film discussed at the start of this episode. Also included are films called Episode, Sense, Alibi, and Phonio, the latter a celebration of grainy footage recorded on a mobile phone. The moods of each film are distinct, with the joyous jump-cutting of Radio contrasted with the harrowing darkness of Alibi, or the uncanny melancholy of Episode and Sense. Viewed together, writes Chris Krause, the five films form a trajectory, a kind of ontological diary that starts with herself, or her ambivalent romances, as subject, and eventually fans out to a point of omniscience and disappearance. That use of technology designed for everyday use seems to crop up in most of the pieces now, whether it's old Super 8 footage or shot on your phone or edited in iMovie and so forth. Is that particularly important, the accessibility of the filmmaking apparatus?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's like, well, what's available and how can I maybe subvert it? It's a bit like found footage. It's like, what materials do I have? It's like, you know, it's like painting with house paint or whatever's around, or bits of charcoal. I like to use what's there. I mean, yeah, I think I quite like working with what's there and subverting it.
Well, it's asserting your authority as a user rather than as a customer.
Yeah, exactly. And that you know, as a user, you can be really creative. I mean, look, come on, it was already, you know, the French New Wave or any of the new waves were already like, well, you know, the technology allowed for portable 16mm. Mm-hmm. Why not use it? Why not use available light? I mean, I really hope that my films don't look like some kind of cheesy, nostalgic, you know, my parents' wedding anniversary and, you know, with kind of scratches on top. In a way, this is a feminist thing as well. I hope that, you know, anyone would give me credit that I'm using something consciously and I'm not just like a rubbish filmmaker. I mean, you know, I think when I started out, people used to kind of think that I was a rubbish filmmaker. Well, because of the, you know, the technical lo-fi. I mean, I really think of myself as arte povera. I really think that, you know, I don't think you should spend a lot of money on making art. I think it corrupts. I think, you know, the more independent you can be, the more close you come to kind of experimental.
Yeah. And with the sort of with the not wanting to spend a lot of money, and you mentioned ripping DVDs, is there a sense in which you're sort of quite happy to pinch a bit of that, in the sense that that's a filmmaker that's probably made a lot of money from that already? You know, is that a political?
Exactly. And it's also the collective commons. It really is. And it's like there's so much piracy. I mean, I found out in New York that people were pirating my videos and, you know, artists and watching them, you know, so fine. I mean, everybody does that. Some, you know, I think it's a bit sad that some filmmakers, you can't really access their stuff easily, especially experimental filmmakers. And you have to, you know, go to video data bank and pay $100 or whatever for a Sadie Benning film. I don't make all my work completely accessible because, you know, in the art context, I get paid a bit. Actually getting a bit of money, not in England, because it's never that lucrative here, but, you know, if somebody puts on a show in Europe, they pay the artist.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quite easy to feel kind of worthless and that your work is never going to make you anything. So I'm kind of torn. I would like to make some money because we have to live. And at the same time, I don't want to compromise. But yeah, in terms of the right to cite and collective commons, I think, you know, these are cultural artifacts. And I'm talking about culture. So why not? Roman statues, you have imparted knowledge to idiots upon whose lips hang
disappointment.
You have recorded the song of the nightingale and sold it as bedroom noises. You have vended streets and streets to traders and then set them free. You have impersonated Adolf Hitler.
Simple story,
deception,
stories
of deception. Contraceptives, with jungle-funded fabric and cigars. You have bathed new.
I keep stumbling, blinking into rooms. I asked the boatman on the River Styx to take me to the other side, and she said, for a price, for a price.
A clip there from Ruth's film Alibi, featuring her own voiceover. The visuals of the film evoke the darkest examples of film noir, while the narration from Ruth encapsulates the hard-boiled monologues often uttered by men in earlier films and crime novels, here transposed to a female narrator.
I love film noir. I love the fact that it emerged at a really dark time in history as this hard-boiled. I was reading a lot of Raymond Chandler when I started doing my PhD. I didn't read any theory. Well, I read a bit of theory, but mainly I just read a lot of Chandler, James M. Cain, And I thought, how do you take the sort of hard-boiled noir and, you know, turn it around so that women embody, you know, women can talk about the dark side of human nature and have a hard-boiled kind of tone. And also I just loved, German Expressionism. You know, it's really weird that German Expressionism, you know, flourished just before Hitlerism kicked in. And then it sort of transferred across the Atlantic and became, you know, sort of dark American crime drama.
You don't simply speak in your films as you're speaking to me now. There is a slight affectation there, which is in that kind of hard-boiled vein, isn't it?
Absolutely. I use my own voice now more. Yeah, I think those Moorish films really couldn't have had my London accent. Because also the other thing about class in this country is that your accent defines your class, and it takes all the kind of... I wanted a narrator to be a narrator, not me. So it's personal, but it's not. You know, this is my transatlantic persona, or the person I was when I lived in New York, or sometimes I have this accent as well, you know, because I don't want to be... No, some of my work has my actual accent.
Yeah.
It's not the narrator's voice. It's not.
No, it's just more. It's more the method of delivery, the tone of the voice, rather than, you know, that rather than putting an accent on top. So,
yeah, I think it is tonal, and I think it's. I don't know, because a lot of people have thought that that's a weakness in my work, using this sort of fake American accent.
Right.
Other people like it and think it's kind of Lauren Bacall-ish and has a kind of. I don't think it could be otherwise. I don't want my accent putting me in, you know, North London in the 21st century.
Yeah. Yes, there can be confessional elements, but it's filtered through several layers,
Yeah. Not
simply documenting an experience.
Yeah, it's not exactly, you know, it's not autofiction, really. It's like, you know, my protagonists and my characters are... They're characters. They're not fully me. And you know, I wouldn't want to make purely confessional work. It's, you know, they're poetic in a way. Like you don't sort of rummage through poems looking for biographical detail. You kind of take them as they are.
Is there a sense in which you see your on-screen figures as sort of avatar-like?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think, you know, I'm trying to express myself. And I think I've always been trying to express myself since I was a kid. And it always seems, that's probably why I carry on making work. It always seems that I haven't quite reached that real expression, or that there's always room to kind of explore more. Sort of. And it is time and space, because with film you can cheat space as well. You can cut from one thing to another, you can compress time, you can expand time.
I mean, it could be New York, it could be London, it could be anywhere, couldn't it? So it's...
Yeah.
That sense.
But it really is jumping from. I mean, for instance, in Sense, it goes from New York to Venice. And actually looking back at it, I was thinking, oh yeah, like, you know, I had this sort of fantastic time in New York and a sort of very dramatic love affair, and then we broke up. But I kept reflecting back on it and that time through that footage, because I felt it was kind of unfinished and I needed to kind of process it. You know, the Venice footage, I was there, like my dad said to me at one point, it looked like the Venice, it looked like, you made it look like tombstones. I thought, yeah, it's true. It looks really like solitary, dead, the coffee, the cigarette. There are no other people, just these dark...
dark windows. And
yeah. And then it ends just going, flying off again. There are so many planes in my work, partly because I adore the image of being above the clouds, looking down on mountains, looking down on coastlines. It's you know, this overview that I want of the world, encapsulated in this idea of, but also the escape. My diasporic sense of self feels free when I'm on the way somewhere.
She was lurking in doorways, playing detective. The suspense was killing me. I wanted to step out of time. I wanted to live in nowhere.
Images of travel are to be found in Novacek's most recent films, Eat the Dust and What's the Story? The first of these, Eat the Dust, is once again shot through with notions of a lack of belonging and existing in troubled times. Two dancers are seen early on, yet we observe and do not participate, as a later subtitle emphasizes, in the margins, watching but not being seen. A love affair is briefly glimpsed but snatched away from us. A suggested attempt at reading the dregs of coffee from a cup suggest superstitious undercurrents, while images of trains, cars and trams show very little personal interaction. The final image is similarly dance-like. A woman dribbles a basketball between her feet, the ball as restless as her movements. The latest film, What's the Story, opens with an image of travel, weighted with dark associations, as a lonely train wends its way through a snowy, barren landscape. The rest of the film, however, turns the attention to the role of an unreliable narrator, with considerable humour along the way. Subtitles often appear along the bottom of the screen, not matching with the spoken dialogue, although many of the phrases are heard elsewhere. Images of dance and music making return, many of these from classic movie musicals and romances. Love affairs are implicit rather than explicit in this film, though one of the film's citations is the 1929 work Pandora's Box featuring Louise Brooks. An icon of pre-code film stars, she is known particularly for her embrace of liberated sexuality. So why this affection for rather early film material?
I don't think it's nostalgia. I think it's more that I would really like people's historical view to be more extended. And I learned that from teaching. I had, like, let's say we're watching Hitchcock's Notorious. Nobody understands that if you keep your clothes on, it's a love affair. And they also didn't understand smoking. You know, I'd have to explain to them that smoking was not, you know, considered a terrible thing in the 1940s, and that people didn't like take off their clothes and shag in the 1940s because of, you know, the code or just, you know, general conventions of the time. So I think it's less nostalgia and more like plus ça change, that, you know, actually not much has changed. It's like feelings, emotions. You know, the music, I mean, it's what I listen to. I'm, you know, I'm really eclectic, and I've always been really eclectic. And I think that's another reason, you know, that I've sort of broken away from whatever the co-op idea was. But the fragmentation, I think, goes deeper than just a sort of urban political. It's my own moodiness, my own sort of ability to kind of move between, you know, channeling and different notions of fluidity of self, really. Let's call it that. My own fluidity of self is fragmented. A lot of feminists have talked about fragmentation as being a natural, you know, it's like a correlation to Fanon's sense of, or Du Bois's double consciousness.
I mean, it's curious in terms of identity that you've mentioned a lot of labels, whether that's, you know, artist, Jewish, lesbian, feminist, all of those things. Is that in itself a problem? You know, if we think of, as a viewer, if we think of Ruth Novacek as that person who made those things that I like, and then everything else is kind of by the wayside. But
yeah, because then it's up to you.
Yeah,
to make what you will.
Yeah,
of reading whatever you might read into it. Because I'm always surprised that there are some men that like my work, and I'm thinking,
yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, once it's out there, you can read what you like. As for all those labels, it's just, it's my political and social positioning. It's positionality, isn't it? It's like I have to state my positionality. I could also state that I'm, middle class, had a good education, didn't struggle, could eat when I was a child.
And the use of humour in relation to these things, does that also allow an irony, a distance from the...
I wish I could find things as funny as I used to.
Okay.
But yeah, often I do. And often, sometimes it's just better to laugh. And in a way, fascists don't have a sense of humour. I mean, fascists... There's nothing funny about a fascist. They don't have any jokes. I mean, and in a way, the absurdity of these seriously fascistic people and how they control. Every time I go to the shop and they've got the newspapers set out and, the Daily Mail. I mean, for fuck's sake, my first response is anger. Actually, yeah. We've got to keep laughing. I think in one of my films, there's a quote from Walter Mosley, and it's like, the world we believe in is not the world we live in, or something like that. And I think that's, there's something in what I was trying to do with film was kind of make a world that was livable.
I suppose it is as well, because despite the darkness in some of them, they're often quite a lot of fun as well. So
yeah. And also, like, why shouldn't they be dark? I mean, I'm not doing a utopia. I am trying to kind of explain my... inner world, in the way that cinema in general does. It's got a poetic resonance. It is world making.
Yeah, and what's sort of appealing to me is you're presenting a vision of the world, but it's also a vision of the world that is very, very conscious of being in a multimedia landscape.
Yeah, that's because I was thinking, I don't know if I want to call myself an artist anymore. It doesn't quite explain. I feel I'm a cultural contributor. I'm very interested in culture. And I read a lot. I listen to music. I'm always looking for music to listen to. I go to the cinema. I'm really interested in what's happening culturally and politically. It's like, am I a journalist? I'm starting to kind of be quite a news junkie. Because I do think that in using cinema, my films are sort of saying, I'm interested in the world. It's not just my little... I hope that my films aren't a kind of claustrophobic, dragging you inside my head kind of experience. I hope that they kind of... And also in using like loads of different locations in one film, I'm kind of saying, well, I am a rootless cosmopolitan. I'm sort of... I see myself as a citizen of the world. Find the experimental films you like, that have the elements you like, that have the sounds and images you like, and find a way to find them. Because, generically, it's so broad, you can't say, you could say, be prepared to be bored, or settle into being bored, or find the stuff you really like that excites you, that has an element in it that resonates, and then find a way to find them. Films that I don't enjoy are the ones that I want to get up and walk out of within about the first 5 minutes. So another way to enjoy experimental film is sit near the back, near the door, so that if you really don't like it, you can leave. Or develop the patience to sit with something. And also watch everything as if it's experimental. Watch mainstream film as if it was an experimental film. But yeah, definitely we need to figure out the genre, because it's not a genre. if you want to enjoy experimental film and not just sit there in agony because, you know, you're sitting through like an hour of silence and nothing happening, then that's how not to enjoy
experimental. Yeah. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, don't forget to subscribe. We'll be back with more very soon. You can find many of the films that we've discussed on Ruth's Vimeo pages, as well as on the DVDs mentioned earlier. My thanks to Ruth Novacek, of course, for being so generous with her time and for allowing the use of clips from her films. Thanks also to Gabriel Ness, who composed the music for this show, and as always, thanks to you for listening. Hope you'll join us again soon.